Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode deals with some material that may be difficult or triggering for some people. So just wanted to start up by letting you know the National Sexual Assault Hotline is available at 1-800-656-4673 if you or someone you know needs help or needs someone to talk to. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Jane Costin, ProPublica's Dara Lind. We're going to talk about a case, true crime, that has ripples into the political world.
Right.
And that is the case of Jeffrey Epstein, who has been kind of hovering on the borderlines of political attention for several years,
right,
burst back into the scene as he was rearrested, charged with a new set of crimes, leading to the resignation of the Secretary of Labor and more.
Yes. And before we get started, I think that it's really challenging because I hear, I've been reporting on this along with a host of other people. And there is a tendency to try to talk about the story of kind of like, ooh, rich people moving around. But at its base, this is a story about a serial sexual abuser. And I think for a lot of people, this content has been really triggering. So I just want to say that the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-4673. I know that the subject can be really hard for a lot of people, especially when it's coming at such a trying time for a lot of people in general. So I just want to put that forward. But I think we should just get started by...
I actually want to say that if you want to tap out of this episode but still tune back in for the white paper, we're going to put the timestamp for when we start with the white paper in the show notes.
Yes.
So that you can skip this section and then come back in for a relatively uplifting paper about Civil War pensions and racial life disparities.
So I think we should just get started by explaining who Jeffrey Epstein is, because I think even that has become contested because, in news descriptions, people are like, oh, billionaire money manager. And then a lot of folks started asking, like, how do we know he's a billionaire? And then it turns out that he may not be entirely a billionaire.
Or even really necessarily a money manager.
Right.
But he's some kind of rich guy.
Yeah. And so his story, he is now 66 years old. He started out at Bear Stearns in the early 1980s. His exit from Bear Stearns is questionable. Some of the people who have said that he was running a Ponzi scheme are people who ran larger Ponzi schemes. So it's a lot of crooks talking about other crooks.
Well, I think let's flash forward to the case and then back to his backstory.
Okay, that sounds good to me. So the current case that we're talking about is that there was a Miami Herald investigation into both his sexual abuses, but also the amazing deal he received from, at the time, top federal prosecutor in Miami, Alexandra Acosta, who you may recall as having been Secretary of Labor until, 15 minutes ago. That deal basically ended a federal investigation into Epstein's trafficking of young women and girls across state lines, which is a federal crime. And it also ensured that Epstein, who could have gone to jail for the offenses they had him for many years, he did not go to jail for many years. He went to, and I'm doing air quotes, which doesn't really come across in podcasts, he went to jail in Palm Beach where he could leave for 12 hours a day to go to an office to do whatever it is he does. And so, you know, there
was, for the record, is like not something that sex offenders are generally given. Like, there's a lot of weird stuff, even just with the chronology of this to this point,
right,
including that, like, this was originally a state investigation and they turned it over to the FBI when there were concerns that the Palm Beach State Attorney's Office was getting involved.
Right.
And like, then the, you know, U.S. Attorney's Office turns out to be perfectly willing to cut a plea
right.
deal. There are lots of weird things that they stipulated to that we'll get into a little bit later.
Right.
That aren't typical.
And we're still learning more. You know, I got a push alert this morning from NBC showing that at the same time that Epstein was making this deal, he was expanding the size of his private island, which is a thing you should not probably, like, it just sounds like a thing you shouldn't be doing. But anyway, so Epstein served.
So what was in the deal? This is a sweetheart deal, right?
He served 13 months. Keep in mind, there was a 53-page federal indictment against him, but rather than deal with that, he served 13 months in county jail in Palm Beach. The deal also, it was a non-prosecution agreement, which shut down the ongoing federal investigation into more victims and other people being involved in the trafficking of young girls. And basically, it meant that he had to plead guilty, and I think this is an important thing. He pled guilty to two prostitution charges. The issue being that one of his victims, these charges were included, was under the age of, I believe, 16. And I'm not sure if people are aware of this, but if you are under the age of 16, you cannot be a prostitute under the law. You are a victim of sexual assault. And I'm becoming increasingly enraged as I talk about this because I find this absolutely enraging. The deal also included wording, according to the Miami Herald, that granted immunity to any potential co-conspirators who were involved in Epstein's crimes.
Which is just like, if you think about this, so much of this, if you think about it from the perspective of what this plea agreement is binding future and other prosecutors to, is wild, right?
Right.
Like the text of this agreement, which is, you know, private, like is kept from the court, not to mention
and
kept from the
victims, yes.
Which is, but it says, you know, essentially, if you are an FBI investigator trying to work a lead on Jeffrey Epstein a decade later, you come across this plea agreement and it says that even though they're not naming other potential co-conspirators, you can't go after them either. It's just the federal government is not known for binding the hands of law enforcement investigators, never mind like binding its own hands in the future. And there's just a lot about this that is not typically how we expect prosecutors to operate.
And normally, if you hear about somebody who is accused of serious crimes getting a sweetheart deal, it would be because they are turning in their co-conspirators.
Right. Right. Oh, right? And this is
rather
the other,
than the opposite.
This is the other wild thing about this. This agreement says that Epstein was providing valuable information to law enforcement.
Right.
And we do not know, it is not in that agreement what that valuable information is. Now, the Miami Herald, in this really excellent investigation that came out at the end of 2018 about all of this, did kind of put some dots together and note that around this time, Epstein was testifying against a couple of his former colleagues at Bear Stearns, this is the late 2000s, the mortgage crisis was happening, Bear Stearns had gone under, and they were under indictment for federal crimes. They were ultimately acquitted. So, like, there are two possible outcomes here. Either Jeffrey Epstein was giving valuable information on something that we still don't know about, that, like, its value is TBD because we don't really know how he would have contributed to it, or Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal on a bunch of sex crimes for testifying in the trial of two dudes who ultimately got acquitted of white-collar crime.
I would also say, I mean, we know, you know, looking back 10, 11 years later, that it's just not the case that the federal government put a super high priority on making financial crimes cases at that time. I mean,
right.
You could imagine a scenario in which somebody got a sweetheart deal on sex crimes for doing state's evidence on some kind of terrorism charges. And I think people could debate whether or not that was a good set of priorities for the federal government to set. But it is clearly true that the federal government in the 21st century has placed a very high investigative weight on terrorism charges, right? Even if that was in some sense like a paperwork sense, like the reason he was given this deal, it's not the reason. Like, people were not calling down for main justice to every U.S. attorney in America saying, like, do everything we can to make cases against the bankers.
Especially if the alternative is making a case against sexual abuse of minors, right, which has definitely been a priority for both administrations, Justice Departments, but right, certainly of Republican Justice Departments
for
the last couple of years.
And so this is the there's more to Acosta's departure from the Trump right administration, but this had sort of been known, but the Herald like really put the dot on it.
That, right,
like this guy agreed to a crazy deal for no clear reason that he was ever able to articulate.
Right. And even the Herald goes into this, and we should call out the work of Julie K. Brown, who's the Miami Herald reporter who has been like in this from the beginning. But some of the things she points out is the federal prosecutors said things like that they were intimidated by Epstein's defense team, which included Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, just really the dream team of people who will defend you when you've done terrible
things. Yeah, I definitely want to put a pin in that because I want to get into the defense lawyer mindset
a
little bit
later. But there was a lot of conversation about how they were intimidating witnesses. And Dershowitz, there was a New Yorker piece that came out, I believe, yesterday about Alan Dershowitz, which I think is excellent reading. But it talks about how he allegedly helped to intimidate victims when people were going on their MySpace pages and just being like, this young woman talked about marijuana. And I'm like, this young woman is also allegedly a victim of sexual assault, which turns out can happen at the same time.
Right.
But just the degree to which Epstein was protected, not just by his own defense attorneys, but by federal authorities. And the fact that, like, one of the other things, and we'll get into this more with Epstein, is that he, one of the things that he did, and this was from a piece in 2002, is that he would kind of accumulate famous people around him. And he would say things, and I think Matt will get into this, you know, he would talk a lot about his interest in science at Harvard, but he would just kind of collect famous people to be around him. And he referred to them as a collection, saying, I invest in people, be it politics or science. It's what I do. And so his entire thing was doing weird things like subsidizing scientists to research on Tibetan monks and their meditation techniques and just giving scientists millions of dollars to do this, allegedly.
And also he was buddies with Donald Trump.
Right. And Bill Clinton.
And gave Bill Clinton, I guess in the early days of the Clinton Foundation,
yes,
was a sort of frequent air service for Bill Clinton on right some of his trips to Africa.
Right. Right. But the degree to which he felt comfortable with both having the legal protections that he had and kind of the friend circle he thought, I think, in some senses would like protect him. You know, there's Michael Wolff at Vanity Fair. He wrote there was a piece in 2007 in New York Magazine. And it's funny because Jeffrey Epstein in New York circles, and I'll get into this in a little bit, was like a very well-known person who would show up at famous people events where famous people do famous people things. And he was always surrounded by, to quote Wolff, how shall I say this? By three teenage girls, not his daughters. And Wolf, at one point, when his troubles began, and by troubles, I mean legal investigations into the sexual abuse of young women, he would say, he was talking to me and said, what can I say? I like young girls. And I said, maybe you should say, I like young women. This is someone who thought they could get away with it and essentially did. And right, even in New York, which is where there are new arising charges because more people have come forward. New York District Attorney's Office, which currently led by Cy Vance, attempted to help Jeffrey Epstein by having him reduce his sex offender status to the lowest possible classification, which would have kept him from being on the sex offenders registry and limited the amount of personal information you could find about him. For example, if you go to New York State website right now, you can see where Epstein is in jail and like the number of his vehicles and what the license plates and things like that. That's general information if you are on a sex offenders list. And I think it's worth noting that like for many people who wind up on this list, and even in Florida and elsewhere, like the restrictions on sex offenders are intended to be extremely burdensome.
Right. They're intended to be social death.
Yeah. It's basically you cannot be within certain yards of a school or a playground. You know, there's a community in Florida in which like it's a group of people who are sex offenders who are currently living under a bridge because of where they're restricted to live. But if you're Jeffrey Epstein, you do not have this. And even in this, as reported by the New York Times, when the prosecutor asked this judge to reduce his sex offender status, the judge said, I have never seen a prosecutor's office do anything like this. And, you know, there's still really been no explanation. He was supposed to check in as a sex offender with the NYPD. He never did. He missed more than 30 check-ins with NYPD because reasons. And typically, you know, if you miss, if anyone listening, I know I have some friends who have been public defenders in New York. If you miss one of those check-ins for most normal people, you go, like, you go back to jail unless you're Jeffrey Epstein.
And it's almost right. So I feel like over the last several weeks, since this was really, there was the Miami Herald investigation late last year kicked off a big, like, wow, this is an extremely damning thing to point out about a member of the cabinet. But didn't go anywhere, won a Pulitzer Prize, I believe, despite the efforts of Alan Dershowitz. But, like, it was the rearrest of Epstein earlier this summer that kicked off a lot of, like, what's been kind of an ongoing reckoning on two tracks, right? One is the legal, like, how did Alexander Acosta write such a plea deal, you know, getting him out of office, thinking about what the office of Cy Vance is doing, like, how has there been so much special treatment toward this dude? And the other one is a social reckoning of, like, how is someone who was in elite circles for decades, who everyone appears to have palled around with, who you can, if you go back and look at pieces like the, you know, Vanity Fair piece, other yeah. profiles that have been written of Jeffrey Epstein, there are lots of things that read extremely awkwardly now and, like, don't appear to have been, like, the benefit of hindsight either.
No.
Like, it reads very much like they should have set off some alarm bells for someone at the time. And so the kind of social reckoning of how is this so widely known and yet no one appeared to ostracize Epstein socially because
right.
of it is the other weird thing. And of course, the reason that this is so difficult to discuss is because the legal and social reckonings are coming together, right? Because the
right.
reason the legal reckoning exists is because Epstein was so well enmeshed in social circles. And it raises a lot of really uncomfortable questions about, like, if we think we live in a society where there is no such thing as impunity because of, like, aristocracy, how do we explain what has happened to Jeffrey Epstein?
Right. And I think that you see this. The New York Magazine did a really terrific piece called Who Was Jeffrey Epstein Calling? A Close Study of His Circle, because in while Gawker still existed in 2015, they published his little black book, which had surfaced after a former employee took it around 2005 and tried to sell it. The former employee, by the way, received jail time. And, you know, he had, it basically contains the numbers and phone numbers of victims and social contacts. And among them, it's like Prince Andrew and, like, just a host of people where a lot of the titles are socialite. Mm-hmm. And it is really interesting also, because I think something that's important, I think a lot of people, especially kind of feminists, have been pointing this out, is that the reason, in some senses, why Epstein got away with this is, one, he tended to target young women who were in kind of dire straits. The number of his victims have talked about how he basically, or the people around him, would recruit them when they were most in need. But also, again, I want to make it clear, these were very young people. You know, these were girls who were 14 who still had braces on. And, you know, some of the victims have talked about that there was, like, a before him and an after him and how much that changed their life. But also the idea that, like, being surrounded by 15, 16, 17-year-old girls was just something like, oh, that's a thing. Like, oh, that's just Jeffrey. And you hear this again and again about how, you know, even in Trump, his interview with New York Magazine said something like, oh, he loves beautiful girls as much as I do.
Right. It has even been said that he likes them, you know, that he likes them young or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
And just it's said in such a way that you're like, this was, you know, and I think about this. I spent a lot of time thinking and writing about the Larry Nassar case and USA Gymnastics. In that case, you very much had a sense in which it was the fact that he was masquerading that as a medical treatment, but also, you know, I remember hearing from people who, like, you know, well, he's going after, like, 16, 17-year-olds. That's very, you know, and trying to make this seem as if, like, oh, that's very different from going after children.
Right. So let's take a break, because I want to talk about some of the overdetermined
right.
aspects of this.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So, you know, unfortunately, you would almost like to run, you know, social science experiment where you can try different versions of crimes here, because clearly, like, one important aspect of this is just a sense among many people that the sexual abuse of teen girls by older men is not actually a serious crime.
Yes.
Right? Like, that's like a subtext, what you see in these profiles, right? Where it's not like, ha ha ha, he likes to murder people.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, that's not a joke you would make, right? And so clearly, like, one of the reasons why it seems like he was able to get off light on these charges was a sense that even though, like, legally speaking, this is rape, like, many people do not actually see it that way.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
And, like, that's part of what is happening here. Another part of what is happening here is that we have a very inequitable criminal justice system in a way that I think is important. I was thinking about this all the time in the Ronald Sullivan case at Harvard, which was a big to-do about a professor there who ran a dorm, who was joining Harvey Weinstein's defense team. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pushback in the media saying that, like, it impugns the principles of America's adversarial criminal justice system to castigate an attorney by which clients he chooses. And to me, the Epstein case, like the Weinstein case, like, I don't think that this is true. I think it is convenient for members of the criminal defense bar to believe that extremely vigorous defense of wealthy defendants is like a close cousin to helping indigent defendants. But I think that you see time and again in America that that's not actually right, that actually part of the political stability of the extreme harshness of America's criminal justice system is a shared understanding that wealthy people will not be subject to that harshness.
Right.
That if you can hire really good attorneys and can credibly represent to prosecutors, that you can keep paying those attorneys legal bills, that the prosecutors have a strong incentive to strike a generous deal with you. Mm. Right? That it's not – they don't get, like, extra money for taking on a hard case all the way to trial. They've got a lot of stuff to do. And, like, fighting Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr and a million other people is, like, not necessarily, like, what the system is built to do, right? So I think, like, you really should ask defense attorneys who – I mean, like, if you want to support public defenders, you should support public defenders. But if you are out there, you know, as Alan Dershowitz is in this case, and other people are in other cases, like taking like the deep-pocketed defendants and getting them special treatment, you're not fixing inequities in the criminal justice system. You are exacerbating them.
Right.
But then another level to Epstein is, I mean, this gets into conspiratorial territory.
That's been the entire thing with this, is that like there have been a lot of people who were like, does this mean Pizzagate was right? No, it means that, you know, sexual abuse happens among like every strata of society. But every piece of the story does kind of edge into conspiracy.
Because you
land.
Get into then the question, step at a high level, it's like rich guy charged with a crime. We don't always take sexual abuse of teenage girls as seriously as we should. The criminal defense system is inequitable. Political connections help. Okay, so like you're starting to get a picture of the story. Then it's the other story, which is that it's totally unclear how he got to be so rich, right? And he was working as a math teacher at my high school, and a student there's dad recommended him to Bear Stearns, which I don't think is how investment banks normally get their people.
Well, especially because it's not exactly like he had this sterling record as this, you know, absolute genius who respected
college.
There's that. But even like at Dalton, like to be fully clear about this, the story of Jeffrey Epstein at Dalton is that he got hired because of a very controversial headmaster who liked him. And then there were reports of him being too friendly with students, right?
And eventually that headmaster, by the time I was a student there, was forced out in a sex scandal. So, you know, one thing leads to another. At any rate, now he's working at Bear Stearns. Then he goes from Bear Stearns and he has his own firm. And then there's this follow-up reporting, and it's – you can't prove a negative exactly. But people keep saying, look, it doesn't seem like he actually made this money, like trading options. Like it doesn't – we tend to know how the most successful hedge fund managers made their money because their trades become visible. And you're like, aha, you know, George Soros made all this money shorting the British pound. And then when they had to break their trading bin, like he made billions of dollars. And so we can tell that story. Nobody can tell the story of how Jeffrey Epstein made all this money.
Right.
And he had extraordinarily close relationships with several of his clients, including most notably the Victoria's Secret guy.
Leslie Wexner, who referred to him as a most loyal friend with excellent judgment and unusually high standards. And to the extent of like everything about it is like, like, Epstein was trusted, Victoria's Secret, which I find very funny because in the old catalogs, they always use the British spelling of everything. It's based in Ohio. And one of the things that Wexner did was like, okay, I'm going to go to New Albany, Ohio, and I am going to, like, rebuild this town. And who helped him? Jeffrey Epstein.
Right. So his number one so you have a guy, right, like, sexual abuser. His number one client, who he has a weird relationship with, like Epstein had a power of attorney over this guy's fortune. So it's not like a normal money manager type stuff. And like he runs a freaking lingerie company, right? Mm-hmm, so the implication across all of this, and to be clear, like the reporting has not demonstrated this, but what is being driven at, I would say, by a lot of these investigations is the possibility that Epstein's professional work for his financial clients is directly connected to this question of trafficking in underage girls and procurement of prostitution. That, like, we know in the financial services industry that wining and dining of clients is, like, something that you do, right? And if you happen to have some unusual tastes in that regard and can find clients, like maybe there's something there. Now, again, like I don't want to libel anybody. We don't know what's going on. But there is not a like clear, overt explanation of what it is this relatively small number of people were doing in trusting all their money to this sex criminal.
Yeah. And I understand. I mean, it's so freaking hard, especially because, you know, to have had Pizzagate 3 years ago and to now be dealing with a world in which, like, it is very hard to look at the facts of this case and go, oh, yes, but if something more overt were to happen, then surely law enforcement would have been all over it.
Right.
It's kind of the best way I can think of to put that. But, like, you know, I think that it's very difficult to kind of, you know, to prove negatives here, to assert why people would have been friends with someone. That's always, like, as weird as the sycophancy directed toward Epstein is, like, you have, like, Harvard physicists saying he has the mind of a physicist. And then you read the actual things Jeffrey Epstein is saying that are supposedly so smart. And it's like, dude, you sound like a freshman stoner.
Right.
But, you know, the sycophancy is weird. But I think it's easier to point out that regardless of what the positive motivation for friendship with Epstein was, nobody saw the girls thing as a deal breaker, right? And this gets, I mean, this is something that you were pointing to earlier, Jane, but it also, there's an essay that you should, that we'll put in show notes, that was posted on The Cut by Lisa Miller that very provocatively, and maybe not 100%, like, maybe you take this with a grain of salt, but lays this at the feet of the fact that this entire generation of dudes is a product of the sexual revolution, and that there was such an emphasis there on the, you know, freeing of the male libido in the name of liberation.
Right.
And that, you know, clearly that, like, sex was always healthy. And, you know, the way that she puts it is that it reduced sexual violence to a matter of taste. And you don't necessarily have to believe that, you know, everyone who Jeffrey Epstein ever interacted with was interacting with him for the purposes of sleeping with young girls to understand how the lines between, oh, I am socializing with this person, I am at this person's parties where there are young girls around. You know, there are so many, like, lines here that could be crossed that seem very bright to us, but may seem less bright if you have become an adult in an age where you're being told that there is nothing harmful about sex.
And I also think, I want to go very quickly back to the point about, like, no one knows how he made this money. Another great piece in New York Magazine talked to people who actual hedge fund managers who basically were like, we've never traded with him. We've never had anything to do with him. And there are not that many New York-based hedge fund managers on earth. And no one knew who he was. But I, going to Dara's point, I think that that's been something that's been challenging is that, you know, there have been a lot of people who want to use the Epstein case as like a political cudgel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's almost helpful that you can't really do this because this is it cuts across political ideology and because, you know, you had Katie Couric went to one of his parties, but Donald Trump was around. Like, you had people from, you know, from across a, you know, political strata, but all a part of this very wealthy part of New York and Palm Beach society, where everyone kind of knew each other. Of course, you would go to his parties or something like that. But the idea that you would see that, and again, not think like that's weird, but also think of it, you know, you heard in, especially in early writings about Epstein, as you note, that the girls are kind of brought up as like, oh, that's interesting. And it almost reminds me a little bit of, you know, if anyone watched E! In the early 2000s, they remember the show about Hugh Hefner and the Playboy Mansion and Girls Next Door. And kind of that was just like, oh, this is like an interesting television show about these interesting people, except that, you know, the requirements of being one of the playmates closest to Hugh Hefner was to have sex with Hugh Hefner. And it's just this idea of like how this is posited that you would go to these parties. And, you know, one of the things also about Epstein is that he got very close with like women who were perceived as being very powerful or strong or something like that. There was something, a line of like he would date women and then he would like stop dating them, but then they'd become friends and they'd like move up in his circles. And some of them were obtaining girls for him, but also this idea of like the women weren't opposed to this or didn't say anything.
So I agree with this high-minded take, but I do also want to make a narrow partisan point, which is that there is something extraordinary about the fact that the Trump administration, the Trump transition team, having had one labor secretary's nomination be spiked because it turned out that he was beating his wife,
right,
went as their number two to this guy who, like, it was known at the time. Like, this was in the coverage at the time that he'd struck this shady plea deal that the victims were complaining about and were trying to get the legal machinery turning to get some to get this overturned somehow, and that like neither their internal vetting team nor Senate Republicans like pumped the brakes on this at some point to be like, can we take a closer look at this situation? Because as soon as the Miami Herald took a closer look at the situation, the whole thing became untenable.
Right.
And so now, of course, like Donald Trump is really sloppy in his vetting. Like on some level, like we know that it's very Trump era that like a cabinet secretary was forced out of his position because he had brokered some kind of corrupt sweetheart deal with a major sex criminal. And that's like, we're talking about it now, but like the political news cycle has like moved on to seven new Trump scandals, right, including like taking bribes from the Saudi Arabia to export nuclear weapons technology to them. But like, we are running an incredibly slipshod.
Right.
Presidential administration here, of which like the way that this just kind of passed in and out of the gates is like one of many, many, many examples.
Right. I mean, it definitely does say something about the way we expect news cycles to work, that this is no longer a political story now that Alex Acosta is out.
Right.
And it's now a social story, even though like the kind of social story involves in large part looking back at reports of Jeffrey Epstein hanging out with Donald Trump and Tom Barrack, who was on the transition team in the 90s. And so, you know, there was this is going to sound very far afield, but I promise it's a useful comparison. Politico magazine ran a story recently about Mike Pence getting a potential federal judgeship nomination scotched because the potential nominee was in his state government in Indiana. And so he was worried and his team were worried that if you put this guy up for confirmation hearings, there would be a lot of tough questions about what he was asked to defend in Indiana. And like, not necessarily even assuming anything corrupt or scandalous on Pence's part. They were just like, you know what? There are some controversial things in here that we don't particularly want to remind the public that we did when we were in Indiana state government. Why don't we not provide the Senate with an opportunity to ask these questions? The fact that Tom Barrack didn't have that thought about, gee, it's very easy to go from Alex Acosta to Jeffrey Epstein. It's very easy to go from Jeffrey Epstein to like me and the president and other people on this team. And that wasn't a reason to stop it. It says a little bit about the slipshodness. It also says something about the completely accurate calculation that the Donald Trump team has made, that has only been proven more correct with time, that sexual morality doesn't hurt them at all because they have a large swath of evangelicals who have convinced themselves that like he is, you know, a world historical great leader.
What, right. You know, they start using the biblical story of David, which apparently they didn't finish because, you know, it ends with more difficulty for King David than perhaps the story, if you work at Liberty University, the story you're telling. But I think that currently Epstein's in jail. There will be more movement soon. More victims are coming forward. But I think the fact that Alexander Acosta thought that, because there was talk that this wasn't the big issue for Acosta, but it's his views on trade that were going to be the big challenges. And the degree to which the administration attempted to defend Acosta, including having him do a press conference, which was not a good idea.
No, and it does seem like ultimately, the reason this knocked Acosta out is that Mick Mulvaney had been clashing with him over... Basically, Mulvaney wanted Acosta to do some legal envelope pushing in terms of implementing conservative anti-union policies. That's why he was vulnerable to being pushed out in scandal. And in some ways, it cut the whole politics news cycle of this short. But, you know, I mean, the other thing that I do think you see here, something you mentioned before, is like part of the social context for Epstein being buddies with pre-politics Donald Trump and with post-politics Bill Clinton was, I think, a sense for a number of decades that a certain kind of sexual libertinism should be seen as in alliance with a certain kind of feminism,
right,
as opposed
to
a certain kind of scoldy, churchy,
right, and cosmopolitanism.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And that a bit something you've seen on a rolling basis in the Me Too era, I think, is a reevaluation of that,
right,
constellation of forces and a little bit more of an appreciation of a Andrea Dworkin kind of
Yeah, this has definitely been, reading about the Epstein case, I've definitely been like, I think Andrea Dworkin was right the whole time. But no, this idea, and, you know, I think that there's been a lot of conversation about this with regard to Bill Clinton. The Slow Burn podcast goes into this quite a bit. But yeah, this the level of kind of perceived acceptability, and, you know, it's telling that one of the people Epstein found the most bond with was Woody Allen, who would know something about, you know, being an inappropriate, trashy person. But this, you know, this kind of, that was kind of something, a cut across ideological silos. And now you're seeing that with Republicans who, you know, there's this idea, and I think that it's worth challenging, that, like, things about Trump are now baked in. But there's also an idea of, like, what exactly people know about Trump, you know, what is baked in. But I do think that there's a sense of, like, we didn't elect a choir boy. But I'm like, no, there's a difference between a choir boy and palling around with Jeffrey Epstein. And I think that there are a lot of questions that remain to be asked about that. I think it's important that we keep in mind that these are at, you know, this has not yet gone to trial. We've got, there's a lot more to learn. But I do think that there's a sensibility here that Epstein, it's not like he was trying to get away with it. He just seemed to get away with it by happenstance. You know, he moved to New York and had fancy parties at his very large home that was full of extremely creepy things like statues of eyeballs and members of his staff made into giant sculptures to be chess pieces you could move around. And people are like, that seems normal.
Honestly, I'm interested that you went with Bill Clinton, because this brings me back to Alan Dershowitz, right?
Because
there's something about, like, the kind of defense lawyer's argument here that, like, you can see a world in which this happens in a purely consensual fashion that strikes me as both very illustrative and very disingenuous, right? Like, Alan Dershowitz has, you know, one of the things he's recently trying to defend himself of that's kind of come to light as people have put together some puzzle pieces of his past in context of the Epstein stuff, is an op-ed he wrote way back in the 90s about how, like, statutory rape doesn't, you know, hold water because teenagers should be informed enough to consent to sex. And, like, that makes sense from a very mid-century liberal. Of course, you want to emphasize the agency of women. Like,
and he brought up, like, Romeo and Juliet cases,
right,
which, you know, and I think it's worth noting here, because I've had these conversations. There are some cases in which, you know, someone is 16, but they're dating an 18-year-old, and then the 18-year-old is charged with statutory rape. And that is not this.
But to make the 90s politics explicit, he says in there, look, if you think a 16-year-old should be able to get an abortion, she should be able to consent to sex with an older man.
Right.
And that is, like, exactly the, I think, like, that was on point, I think, to, like, 90s liberalism as an argument.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of the kind of the way to square, if you're someone who is kind of either dealing with whiplash, looking back at, like, oh, my God, how would feminists in the 90s, like, not have been, like, obviously, how did anyone allow this to happen at the time? Or looking forward to, like, wow, how did liberals get so prudish about sex? Like, the answer here is that the idea of power has become more central to feminism over the last, maybe even just arguably the last decade. And so the specifics of these cases, the difference between a Romeo and Juliet 18 and 16-year-old and a case in which, you know, someone is, like, finding near homeless 14-year-olds and cultivating them matters a great deal. And, like, it doesn't necessarily matter to you if you're in rarefied intellectual circles where the purpose of this is largely a thought experiment or an op-ed or a defense or if you're a defense attorney who is trying to make the most airtight logical case for your client. But when we're talking about law, logic and morality exist in really close quarters. And so, you know, getting back to Matt's point about the choices you make as a defense lawyer, like, it's actually very important to the way that Harvard Law School trains its students to have them have someone on staff, on faculty demonstrating that, like, yes, even the hardest seeming case, you should be able to make a vigorous defense for your client, not necessarily because it's morally important that a vigorous defense be made, but to demonstrate that it's possible, because many of you guys are going to be going out to big law where you're not going to have the choice of your clients, but you're going to have to make the most airtight case. Like, the idea that making the strongest case and not picking who you're representing is an important, you know, principle of the legal profession is really baked in, but it blurs the line when we're talking about lawyers as public figures or when we're talking about people in their private lives. And the liberal idea that once you've made the airtight logical case for why something could be okay, looking at the specific power dynamics of the situation becomes less important is something that I think has not gotten a lot of traction among younger progressives and probably is not, you know, to the extent that like it's that you can draw a line from that to Jeffrey Epstein is probably not going to age very well.
Right.
Take a break and do a white paper.
Sounds great.
All right.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
So you have today physician bias and racial disparities in health, evidence from veterans' pensions by Shari Ely, Treven Logan, and Boriana Milucheva. This is looking at Civil War pensions, which gives us it's one of these things where like it's a rich administrative data set. So people study it a lot. But also it's a really interesting thing that they are looking at. And they look at basically doctor to get a pension, you had to be certified as disabled. And so you needed a doctor to certify that. And they are able to look at, you know, who got certifications, and they see that doctors were much, much, much more reluctant to certify African-American veterans as disabled. Consequently, they got much stingier pensions, and then they are able to do a lot of statistics which demonstrate that actually this disparity in the income levels is enough to fully account for a subsequent gap in mortality. But to me, I mean, it's just the sort of baseline discrimination finding that is very interesting. What interested me about it, actually, is I was at a conference recently, and we got to talking about racial wealth gap in the United States, and we got to talking about very complicated and sophisticated ideas, which I think are important. I don't discourage people to think about complicated and sophisticated ideas, but there's a lot of evidence for just like really basic discrimination. There are good like audit studies of names on resumes. There's this study about the pensions. And in a weird way, I mean, I always want to encourage smart people to like not fall too in love with like their own like really impressive smart ideas, because I feel like in some of these conversations, we can just like talk past the evidence for like the most banal forms of discrimination being significant drivers of important sorts of outcomes. And they connect this in the paper to a literature about present day medical treatment in which like African-Americans don't get as much like pain medicine and are just like not believed by white doctors.
Right. And, you know, there's been interesting research even just on the idea of doctors thinking that African Americans are less prone to feel pain. Even some research on the belief, this is not true, that Black people have, and I mean this literally, thicker skin. So, for example, with regard to giving shots to children, the idea that you could use a larger gauge needle because Black people would have thicker skin, which again is not true.
Which is also something you see in like testimony of police officers who have shot African Americans, that
yep.
Like, oh, you know, I They were in a rage. I didn't know what to do. I didn't think I could stop them. They were so strong. And the other interesting side note here is that to the extent that the opioid epidemic has become coded as a white thing, even though it's not, even though like heroin in particular is not exclusively a white drug by any means, that's because the narrative of, oh, it starts when you get, when you have something that a doctor thinks you need pain medication for and so prescribes you opiates for pain. There definitely is suggestive research that African Americans were less likely to be hooked on pain meds by doctors right. because African Americans were being underprescribed pain meds. But to get back to kind of Matt's point about the way that we think about large scale racism, I think that a lot of the reason that it's tempting to look at more complicated explanations is because the alternative is one of two things. The alternative is you think of like interpersonal racism as the result of a few bad apples, and then you start going, okay, how do we get the bad apples out? Or you're faced with the possibility that large groups of people are engaging in behavior that has racist consequences.
Yep.
And that's where we get into the entire intentionality argument about, oh, you shouldn't call people racist. Oh, it's counterproductive to call people racist, that kind of thing. And while I think that it often does kind of reduce the argument to talk about intentions rather than consequences, et cetera, like, it's helpful to have something like this where we can very easily look back and say, yeah, I am comfortable saying that most white doctors in the mid-19th century were racist toward black patients.
Right.
And, like, that is a moral judgment that people are comfortable making. It should not be more difficult to look at similar evidence to the extent that it exists today and say, I am comfortable saying that large numbers of people who may be alive today or whose children may be alive today engaged in racist behavior because that is what the data shows. And more importantly, because identifying that is what it's going to take to solve the problem. We can't bank shot our way out of it, which is, I think, the reason other than just like intellectual humility for accepting this kind of thing is like, it's very easy to say, well, if racism is a complicated problem, the solution must be complicated. Whereas if some of it is just people treating people differently, you can't work around that very
right,
well.
Right, exactly. And I think it's worth saying here that one of the challenges is that, you know, people are like, well, you know, I don't know if he's racist because I can't look into his soul, when it just is like, you can look at the things this person has said or done or the actions they've taken, and that will tell you. Because I think that there's this idea that, like, you know, if you are a racist, that is your number one dedication. You are, you know, the Richard Spencer of the world. Like, you know, your primo job is being a racist. That's what, you know, it comes up top on your CV. That's not how this works. That's not how it ever has worked. People are fully capable of being full-fledged human beings with jobs and identities and people they love and racist all at the same time. You know, and I think that that's been what this has looked like for the course of human history.
To me, an interesting thing about the political context for this, right, is that the post-Civil War era is a little bit unusual in American politics in that many people were very comfortable being overtly racist at that period in time. So you wouldn't have the Trump thing where you like keep saying racist stuff and your whole political strategy is to like whip people up into a racial fury. But then you're like, I'm not a racist. You're the racist, right? Like white supremacists in the 1890s were comfortable labeling themselves as such. Mm-hmm. But also white supremacy was very actively contested at that point in time, right? Which is to say that if congressional Republicans had wanted to create a racially discriminatory pension system, they just would have. You know what I mean? Like, there wouldn't have been, like, in the modern day, you just, like, wouldn't write a law that says, like, and then the black veterans get less money. But, like, the army units were segregated at the
right,
time.
Right.
There was a lot of formal discrimination in the American legal system at the time.
Right. What are you going to use, the Civil Rights Act?
Right. Like, they didn't put formal discrimination into this pension system. Like, they were trying to treat black and white veterans equally, but then they didn't. Right, because of this discrimination at the doctor level. And that is why I think it's important to zero in on, because, like, it shows that if you want to have an equitable outcome, you really may want to rely on some very crude checks, right, where you say, like, we are going to report back and see if black veterans are being assigned pensions at a much lower rate. And if they are, we are going to assume that something has gone wrong, right? And this is like a disparate impact kind of standard, right? Because, of course, it's going to be so hard to look at a doctor and like what he is doing and show a discriminatory pattern, much less a discriminatory intent. But it's really easy to see in the aggregate here that this is what's happening. And unlike in certain other cases, I mean, we have pretty good reason to believe that the legislative architects of this system like genuinely did not want this outcome. But it's the outcome that they got because they didn't try hard enough to avoid it, which I think you have a lot in America. I mean, I think there is a lot of reluctance to rely on like crude quota systems and things like that, that like people want to say like, well, we're going to do something like really fancy or like have like workshops and solve things. But like you have a lot of really sort of basic problems can arise and sometimes benefit from crude solutions.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's basically a trilemma of racial justice and social policy, right? On the like prong one, because racism is a big, messy, complicated problem that with a lot of layers, race-blind solutions may end up, because of existing inequities, not having, you know, race-neutral outcomes. Two, talking about policy in explicitly racial terms provokes a huge backlash. But three, also, talking about policy in race-neutral terms that your opponents can say is code for a racially based policy can itself result in a huge backlash. Like the idea that Obamacare was primarily for Black people, the idea that, you know, Black Americans are the predominant beneficiaries of the welfare state kind of thing. Like you didn't need to portray any of these programs as Black programs or even have them, in fact, benefiting mostly Black individuals to have them coded as another way that African Americans sap the wealth of the state. And like, I don't know how you get past, never mind the first prong of that, which is a policy problem. I don't know how you get past the second and third political prongs of that.
Right. I have no idea. It's discouraging.
The weeds. We have no answers.
Exactly.
There you go. Problems without answers. You hate to see it. But there we are. So thanks. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And the weeds will be back after the debates with another post-debate wrap episode with me and Ezra. Bye.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.